Good evening, this is Mark Lynch and this is Inquiry. My guests tonight are Andrew Granville. He is the Canada Research Chair in Number Theory at the University of Montreal and Professor of Mathematics at the University College London. And Jennifer Granville, educator, film and theater producer, writer, and director. And we're talking about their graphic novel, Prime Suspects, The Anatomy of Integers and Permutations. Andrew and Jennifer, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this project.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I'm going to start out right and saying, you're mad, both of you. Of all the things that I've read so far this year, this is the most unexpected project I have come across, which is, let me just put it out there for the audience. It's a graphic detective mystery novel about certain concepts in mathematics, including the structures of integers and permutations. And that is a very weird thing to do. Who came up with this idea?
Well, I did.
I blame him.
Okay, own up to it, Andrew. Why did you think this would work?
Well, I thought the world needed to know more.
Well, that's always true of anything. Okay.
Yeah, I guess so. But in this case, they really did.
You're speaking as a mathematician, of course.
Indeed, okay. Indeed. That is what I do, and I'm interested in popularizing mathematics. And, you know, there are various ways people do it, but often they don't reach a very wide audience. You're always preaching to the converted often when you're trying to go out and reach people, because people quickly switch off from mathematics. So the thought was, what other mechanisms can we go with to reach a wider audience?
And Jennifer, what was your role in this?
Well, my role was, I'm Andrew's older sister. And
I thought you would have good sense, therefore.
You'd think, wouldn't you? Yeah, I've never been any good at math. I've never understood math. I've always been kind of a bit of a failure at math, although my brother would say nobody need be a failure at math, but I always have been. I was an actor. I was thought of myself as an artist and not a scientist, and kind of never the twain shall meet. But my brother has always been very eclectic and able in various different arenas. And he suggested to me one day that it would be fun, in his mind anyway, fun to write a mathematical concept or theorem or paper as a screenplay. And because that's what I was doing at the time, was writing screenplays, he asked me if I'd do it, and I said no. Basically, that was my immediate answer, was why?
No, it's impossible. What a stupid idea.
Okay.
Yeah,
that was your response.
You two are really starting to sound like siblings, by the way.
Yeah, and, you know, he kind of nagged me and bullied me. Gently. No, he's always been a very good brother to me, and he began to intrigue me with some of the ideas that he came up with. And in the end, I thought, why not? Let's give it a go. So I did.
Now, this was originally written as a screenplay, and then you did several live readings. Talk to me about that. Like, it must have been vastly different from this graphic novel.
Yeah.
Well, I'll answer your last point first, which is, you know, when you realize something in different ways, there's things to do with the medium. And of course, in a graphic novel, the illustrator is perhaps the most important figure. And
right.
So, you know, to make things work in that context, in the graphic novel context, he brought a lot of ideas.
And we're talking about Robert J. Lewis.
That's right. Okay. Right. So he would come back to us and say, well, you know, in so many words, I can't see how to make this work. Can we develop the scene in such and such a direction?
We did do some readings of the original screenplay.
I'd love to know how that worked. How many people? Was it just one of you or two of you doing the live reading?
No. We Andrew was actually at the Institute for Advanced Research in Princeton, and he was there for. Sorry?
The Institute for Advanced Study, they're very picky about that.
Sorry.
Yeah, they really are. I've interviewed a bunch of people there that you need to get it right.
Goodness. Oh, dear, I'm so bad. Okay, so that's where he was, and he was there for a year, and he said to me, oh, it would be a great idea. Why don't we do this as a Christmas show? So I sort of said, well, it's not really...
it's really festive. Really think,
yeah, it's not really something I could...
You know it.
But I could see it perhaps as a read. So basically, yeah, he managed to get some funding, and we employed actors to read it. But we also brought in an old friend of mine who's a theatre designer, but quite a sort of experimental theatre designer, to kind of give it some kind of visual context. And he helped stage it so that there was some other stuff going on apart from just five actors sitting in a semicircle reading it. So it became more theatrical and quite visual in lots of ways.
I hope somebody videoed this. Did somebody? Is there a video of this presentation? Because I would love to see that.
They did, but to be honest, you know, it's like a lot of live performances. I mean, obviously, people do live performances now, and they really understand how to do it. You know, with all the stuff that comes through from the National and so on.
Right.
But actually, you know, just a straightforward video of a performance is not. Well, you know, it's not great. It's fine. It's a record, but it doesn't really capture the feeling that the audience brings to it and the liveness brings to it. But anyway, we did that.
Let me just interrupt for a second. I mean, in my professional world, I give lectures, and people often videotape them, and they're generally much worse on videotape. And it's not hard to identify, because when I give a lecture, I'm very experienced at working with the audience that's in front of me and reading the visual cues from how they're reacting to what
I
say.
Right.
And I've no clue what to do with a camera, and the design of a lecture has nothing to do with a camera. So people put a camera at the back and film you, but it doesn't work.
No. So that. But then we went on and we did it. Well, after that first reading or stroke performance, the math ed or the science editor from Princeton University Press invited Andrew and I to lunch, and she came up with the idea of presenting this as a graphic novel. I mean, that's as simple as that, actually. It wasn't our idea at all. She actually had the vision and the imagination. So.
It's still a daring idea, and basically because mathematics is, although it relates to ideas that are in the physical outside world, is such an interior science. It's an abstract. And to try to come up with images that would represent, that would symbolize, that would act as metaphors for the ideas that you're talking about, that is very, very difficult. Robert Lewis, the artist, had he done anything in this way before, taking sort of mathematical concepts and literally making people to represent them?
No. I mean, he has had a graphic novel out before, and he works as a designer at a TV station.
Yeah, but that's probably nothing like this project.
I mean, Andrew was the one who really brought the metaphors. He was the one who came up with the idea of twin corpses that turned out to have the same DNA. I mean, that was all from Andrew.
The
protagonists, all the characters who take on elements of different famous mathematicians through the centuries. I mean, not all contemporary by any means. Again, they were people Andrew's always talked to me about. He's always told wonderful stories about math. I mean, you know, I'm doing him a disservice, because he is inspiring when he talks about math and mathematicians. And to be fair, you know, that it wasn't all one-sided. I mean, I wanted to try and tell some of those stories or bring some of those people to life. So it was very much... it was a real, real collaboration between the three of us. And we all brought something of our own skills. But
what a fascinating project!
I mean, it was impossible without Andrew. I mean, he very much was the leader and the inspiration.
Well, it's interesting, because I think one of the characters in the book is Barry Bell, which is based on the author. I think is it Men of Mathematics?
That's right. Yeah.
I remember the first time I read that book, which I think I was in the seventh or eighth grade. And that reminds me of how your sister is talking about you, is be able to tell compelling stories about these people in the history of mathematics. And mm-hmm. and that sort of, you sort of bring that to this book.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, I mean, like you, I read Man of Mathematics with, I think there's one woman in it, but yeah, I mean, you know, I think what Bell did, which I think a lot of people miss, is that history isn't just facts. There's stories right. to be told and right. people to be talked about, and the people are, if you can get an insight into the person, then it brings the whole process and the whole mathematics to a certain extent to life. I mean, obviously, you need a base of understanding of mathematics, but I think it's a lot more fun when it's in a living, breathing context. And Bell's book, well, I'm impressed you were inspired by it in grade 7. That's great. Yeah, I mean, it does something that well, there's many books about mathematics, and I can only name about two or three where I feel like it was anything comparable to Bell's classic.
Huh. Now, I don't want to talk about the theories in this book, because then we're going to go off on a tangent. And talking about math is one thing. Looking at pictures about math in a murder mystery is much more engaging. This is about the anatomies of integers, permutations, and even polynomials in a finite field. But what's fascinating, and you mentioned this at the end of the book, is that there are several other sort of subtexts going on in this book. And I want to talk about each of them. One is how research is done. And the different roles of students and advisors. Talk to me about that. That's really that really does come out in the book.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've had a very interesting experience this week. Funnily enough, a professor of philosophy at Berkeley wrote a review of the book. It was great, actually. Firstly, he got everything, which was lovely. But also, he's one of his research issues is, where do new ideas come from?
Mm.
And people, I mean, there is a tendency in mathematics to think of it all, you start with a set of axioms, a set of well-known facts, and you try and build logically on a solid base. And the reality of what we do is we explore things that we find interesting, and then maybe we find some structure, or we find two things that shouldn't be alike are alike, very unexpectedly, and then we want to explain it. And then, I mean, a lot of what we do is not, it's not that logical. It's trying to get your intuition into a shape where there's some structure to it. And only then do you try and apply the well-worn techniques that allow you to build an infallible proof from the basic objects of mathematics. So I think I didn't really think of it that way when I was suggesting to Jennifer how we go about uncovering the ideas, because it's just the way we do it in my experience. But anyway, to a philosopher, he found that actually quite amusing and intriguing.
Well, they would. Yeah, they would.
I also felt that, you know, as a sort of non-scientist,
yeah.
You know, that similarly, that it must come from sort of knowing stuff and then weaving ideas around it. But what struck me working with Andrew on this was that, you know, it's creative. It's a creative... it's a creative art in many
right.
ways.
Right.
It's not scientific as in fact, 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 and then you add all the facts up and then you get this. It's much more about intuition and instinct and gut feelings, you know, married to, you know, really in-depth knowledge. So, I think that was something that we were quite keen to try and explore and develop.
Also,
that notion of creativity in math.
Also, there is a lot about the role of women in mathematics and by way of mathematics in sciences in general that is covered in this book. And that's something that I think the general public would really appreciates, the fact that that's, that issue is addressed.
Hmm. And right, we started this book 10 years ago. We started this project 10 years ago. So
wow.
I feel that, you know, we weren't, I don't feel we were sort of trying in any way to sort of, we must do something about women. You know, it was very much definitely sort of in the DNA what we were doing from the word go, that we wanted to really, you know, these women are so interesting. The
they
historical
are.
Mathematicians
yeah.
are so interesting. We wanted to pull them in some way. And it's one of Andrew's hobby horses as well, is trying to get more young women
right.
Involved in maths as a career.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guests tonight are Andrew Granville. He's the Canada Research Chair in Number Theory at the University of Montreal and Professor of Mathematics at University College London. And Jennifer Granville, educator, film and theater producer, writer, and director. And together, they created a very unique work. It's a graphic novel called Prime Suspects, The Anatomy of Integers and Permutations. Now, some of the there's a whole cast of characters, a huge cast of characters through this entire book, and most of them are based on real people. And I just want to talk about some that really fascinated me that I wanted to know more about. There's a character, Joe Tendiek, which was based on Alexander Grothendieck. What? Talk to me about his life. Is he the one that ended up living in the Pyrenees?
Yeah, he he was one of the great minds of the 20th century in all of science, but he revolutionized mathematics. And he had a particular viewpoint that was very abstract and very, I find it very difficult to understand. There are people who love it, but it's not working with things that are very tangible. He wants to sort of find out always what's underneath, and it's almost like he doesn't believe reality. He only believes the abstract structure underneath reality. So he changed a lot of the way mathematics was done. Some people say much for the better. Certainly, there are a lot of fantastic understandings that came from his work, but he also created a massive rift in the whole subject. And, you know, he was one of these people who I don't know if he was autistic or what, but he was very focused on his own things to the exclusion of all else, so that one of the famous stories of him is that his greatest protege used some of his abstract structure to prove a theorem in mathematics. It's one of the great theorems of the 20th century, and basically Grothendieck disowned his protege, saying that the time was not ripe for this. You should have waited until the abstract structure showed this as something obvious rather than searched for something beyond the scope of what we were doing. It all sounds a little crazy, I mean, but that was his viewpoint. And when I was young, which is a long time ago now, but there was a real split in science or in mathematics between those who followed the Grothendieck way and those who wanted to do things that were more hands-on and more perhaps like the ancients from times gone by. And those lived uncomfortably side by side. I guess there's two schools of thought inside the subject. In the meantime, Grothendieck, who was, you know, he had this very strong point of view, but he's also a very honest man. He found a structure that, somebody else found the structure that surprised him so much that he said basically half his life work should be ripped up and nobody should work on it. And then there were many people who were invested in developing these ideas that Grothendieck now said were useless. And he got very angry with them, and he gradually fell apart, and he disappeared into his hermit's cabin somewhere in the Pyrenees, where he wrote 5,000-page diatribe about how he felt let down by these other people. It would be an interesting story for somebody who wasn't one of the great geniuses of the 20th century, but he really was, and my work, I feel, is the effect of his work every day, and now it's more and more reinterpreted where people like me can see its value. I certainly couldn't when I was young because it was too abstract. But other people have reinterpreted today what he did to make it more accessible to all and to see the point of it. So he's an interesting
person. He really is an interesting person. It's funny because I was just a couple of weeks ago, I was interviewing a mathematical physicist. And we were the Bourbaki movement came up in the discussion of the history of that. And that was interesting to come across that again in this book. And as you describe it, it was a malign influence.
Well, to my tastes. And, you know, there are people who would be angry at that. But in my own personal career, it at times was very frustrating. People who were so strongly believed in this movement that they wouldn't see other things as valuable.
Now, I want to mention there's a lot of weird walk-ons in this book too. One of them is Silent Bob from Jay and Silent Bob.
Mm-hmm.
Was that either of your ideas or was that the artist's idea?
No, it was kind of, I suppose it was again a combination, because we wanted to have a documentary crew. We had a documentary crew in the original screenplay because we needed every man. Somebody could ask dumb questions, basically. you know, it's a time-honored technique.
The straight man is what you're talking about.
The straight man.
The straight man. Yeah. And then when we transferred it to the novel, it was great because it gave visual interest as well. And we, you know, I wanted to have a sound man with a boom because I thought it was funny. And, but we didn't really. Obviously, the sound man doesn't ask questions or anything. So. He became this sort of Silent Bob character, and we called him Silent Bob amongst ourselves. But then he actually takes on an important role.
He does. Don't give it away. Don't give it away.
Oh, no, I won't. No, I won't. I won't. Okay. But yes, but we called him Silent Bob amongst ourselves, and then when we actually sort of thought about it, we thought, well, let's talk to the creator of Silent Bob and actually see if he minds us calling him that.
And so...
And he didn't.
Yeah, so Kevin Smith gave his permission. I mean, you know, he likes comic books a lot. And,
I know he does.
So our publisher contacted him, and we got permission in a week. I mean, he was just basically, he obviously just said yes immediately. That's fine.
And one of the odd pieces of information about this book is there was a cover that was going to be done by Spain Rodriguez. Now, I'm a child of the 50s, so I was in university at the end of the 60s during the psychedelic era. I have all of Spain Rodriguez's odd underground comic books. Still like Insect Fear and a lot of other weird ones. And I couldn't believe that you were there was the possibility that Spain Rodriguez was going to do the cover.
Well, he, yes. And in fact, he was fascinated by the whole thing. I mean, I knew him personally through a friend of mine who's married to him. And
you knew him personally?
Yes. Oh, yes.
So, what was he? What was he like? Because you know, reading his comics.
Well, he's charming, intelligent, vital, interested, quirky. I mean, well informed,
lively,
fantastic, a lovely, lovely man. And he came. He was blown away by the idea of the whole thing. This is when it was still we were doing it as a live reading, and we did it in Berkeley. And he came. He lives in San Francisco. He lived in San Francisco, and he came to the reading and the performance and absolutely loved it and asked loads of questions. I mean, he didn't really get it, but he asked loads. He just blown away by the idea, really. And then he said, I'd love to do the cover for you. So he said, yes, we jumped on it. And Robert, our illustrator, said, oh, my gosh, on the shoulders of giants. You know, he was absolutely so excited. And it was wonderful. And Spain was working on it when he died, you know, which was tragic. It was a waste, you know, waste of a great talent, because he really was an extraordinary man.
Well, the original sketch for the cover is in this book. And I should mention that to people who are fans of the history of comics. That is amazing. There's so much other elements of this book, too. There's music. Reverie and Primetime Signatures. And you actually print the music sheets in there. When you did the live performance, did you perform the music?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, more than that, I don't know if you noticed this, but there are QR codes on the page where the music is. So if you get a QR code reader and scan it with your phone, it'll take you to YouTube where you can hear the music.
Now, played on what?
Well, what's it played on YouTube?
It's
a harpsichord, a clarinet. I think that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, harpsichord, clarinet. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly, but of all the instruments, this was another sort of funny math story, which is that the composer of the music, another Robert, was a math groupie, really, although he was actually also an indie rock musician. And he went to one of Andrew's talks. He was a bit of a fan of Andrew, and Andrew was telling him about this project that we were working on, and he asked if he could compose some music for it, please.
Wow.
And he did.
If you've heard of Apples in Stereo, that's his band, and Euromilk Hotel, I guess, is he was producer for them.
So he's
an established indie musician, yeah. And I met Robert after I gave a lecture, and we got chatting.
And he's actually now a professor of mathematics. He decided to do a PhD. Within the time that it's taken to do this book, he's become a professor in mathematics as well as a rock musician.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Now, we're almost out of time. I want to mention there's a lot of visual mathematical jokes that are just thrown away in the background as signs. And, you know, and it's really funny because it's just sort of, it reminds me of old Mad Magazine comics where there are all sorts of other visual jokes in the background. Like you have a store for Eureka screws, Yang and Mills light paint, all that stuff. That just sort of, you end up hunting around for all the other little stuff that's going on in the background.
Yay, I like that you did that.
I know, I love that. Leonard E's characteristic cheese. I mean...
Yeah, so great when people get the jokes.
Oh, my God. yeah. The weird thing about this whole project, first of all, it's totally unique, and I love that about it. And there's so many levels to this that you can enjoy this. Now, here's the question, and we're going to be running out of time very quickly. Mm. I hope you two are not going to stop here and stop with this project. Don't laugh. I'm serious. Now you've done it. Now you've gone and done it. Now you've got, is there any possibility that we can expect some other kind of project from you like this?
Oh, my God.
Well, we did have an idea for another project, which I'm not going to say out loud because somebody might steal it. And
sure, I totally get that. But just give me hope that there's going to be some other kind of project.
We have actually got something in the pipeline, which is to do another live performance. But this time, now that we actually have a graphic novel, and with my sort of theatre hat on and my sort of filmmaker hat on, I want to do a live performance that's very interactive and potentially sort of immersive, but using a lot of the visuals from the comic and possibly animating them and so on. So it's kind of morphing into perhaps something else again. And
excellent.
Also, I want to try and investigate the idea of using it to actually do some matchmaking between artists and scientists and try and see if we can get more of this kind of thing
going.
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
I think that would be perfect.
Try and develop.
And maybe animation next time.
There's an idea. I have to say, though, one of the things about getting people together from different disciplines is it's pretty fun working way outside of anything
know.
But what was amazing to me was to discover working for stage designer, for illustrator and others, how much actually our thinking is in common. I mean,
that's
we may be in very different worlds, but the way we approach projects, the way we put together what it is we want to do and how we want to do it, that, you know, you can see all these commonalities.
We're completely out of time, guys, and I hope to hear from you again because this was a load of fun. My guests tonight have been Andrew Granville, Canada Research Chair in Number Theory at the University of Montreal and Professor of Mathematics at the University College London, Jennifer Granville, educator, film and theater producer, writer, and director, and together they produce this project that is one of a kind. It's a graphic novel. It's a murder mystery. Prime Suspects, The Anatomy of Integers and Permutations. Andrew and Jennifer, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.